What's up, friends? Welcome to Wednesday and welcome to another interview episode. I know I am a day late putting this out. I know I normally have interview episodes for y'all on Tuesdays, but yesterday, Tuesday just kind of got away from me, and that's just how life goes. So we're bringing it to you on a Wednesday, which is just as great as Tuesday, honestly. So I am just rolling with it and I am here for it. In other news, I want to welcome you to the month of March. I don't know about you guys, but I was very honest and candid about the fact that February was a brutal month for me. It tends to be brutal for me. It's just a month that is not. I don't know what it is. It's short, but it's still just like brutal. January is so fun and new. And by the time February comes around, the weather in the Midwest is still cold. But like the newness of the year has kind of worn off and it just kind of becomes brutal. So February was hard for me in a lot of different ways. And from a lot of the people I've been talking to, friends and other people, they echoed those same thoughts. So I don't know about you, but I'm just glad it's March and spring is knocking on our doorstep here in Kansas City. It's been in the 50s and 60s pretty much all week, and it's gonna be in the 50s and 60s all week, and it is amazing. We have had the window open in our apartment for a couple days here, and it's so nice just to get back to enjoying spending time outside and just knowing that daylight savings time is around the corner and turning our clocks forward. It's just, I could not be more excited, to be quite honest. In other news, last week I told y'all about Gatsby going to the vet, and yesterday kind of got away from me and I wasn't able to put this episode out is because he had surgery yesterday on his little eyes and he is in full recovery mode right now and he is wearing the cone of shame, and it is quite shameful looking because he is so upset at me that he has to wear this. I can tell he's looking at me with like disdain in his eyes. He's like, he knows I did this to him. One of his eyes like has to be shut for 2 weeks so that it can heal because he had an ulcer on his eyeball. And so he keeps trying to figure out why he can't open his eye. And it's just like, it's kind of funny, but I kind of feel bad for him. And you guys, I don't know, but he's just so dramatic too. I have like the most dramatic dogs in the world. So he gets like a hangnail and it's like the end of the world. And so I know he's coming off his surgery and I know he's probably in some pain, but he's also just like, I mean, the most dramatic dog in the world. And he just looks at me like he has no time for me. He's just like, I know you did this to me and I'm so upset about it. So I am mending him, watching him as he heals. He's got to go back in 2 weeks. So healing vibes to Gatsby. If you are curious how cute he looks in his cone or how pitiful he looks in his cone, you can find me on Instagram, carrie.gillespie. I'm going to post a picture on my stories and peep at how cute he looks in his little cone. Life updates out of the way. Let's get into today's interview episode because I'm really excited about this one. I'm really excited about all of them, but this one is a little bit more of a departure from any guest I've had on, and I'm just really excited for you guys to hear her story and hear what she's doing. Today's guest is Allie Borowski. Allie is the founder and CEO of Find Your Anchor, a nonprofit grassroots movement aimed at suicide prevention, awareness, and education. By trade, Allie is a graphic designer who grew up on the East Coast in Philadelphia. She actually started Find Your Anchor for a school project back in 2012, and after several years of it being her side hustle and passion project, she finally recently took it full time. Since then, they have launched anchor boxes in locations all over the country, and they even recently partnered with Lady Gaga's Born This Way Foundation for the Please Stay Pledge. We cover a lot of ground in this episode, and it was truly such a heartwarming and wonderful conversation for me to have. Allie is so full of light and honesty and love, and she's creating something really incredible. I just want to thank her so much for being so open and honest and sharing her story with me during this entire interview. It is really, really hard to take the messiest, most imperfect, vulnerable part of your story and then look it right in the eye and decide you're going to use it to help other people. But that's truly exactly what she's done and exactly what she's continuing to do. And it's so incredible and just inspiring. And I'm so happy to have her on this episode. And I think you guys are going to love it as well. I have so much respect for what she's creating and how she is working so tirelessly to create a space for other people in the world to make them feel less alone. Before we get into this episode, I want to issue a quick trigger warning here. We talk a lot about mental health and specifically suicide in this episode. So if those topics have a history of being triggering for you, I recommend you just skip this episode for the, you know, well-being of your own health and mental health and whatever you have to do for yourself. Definitely take that time. Without further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Allie Borowski. Allie, welcome to the show. Thanks so much for being here. How are you doing?
I'm good. Thanks for having me, Carrie. Super excited.
Where are you coming to us from?
I am in San Clemente, California.
What's the weather like there?
I'm guessing a lot nicer than you are.
Thanks.
A little warmer. It's about 65 and sunny, so I really can't complain.
Okay, yeah, that sounds pretty lovely. I wouldn't complain about that either. Before we dive into it, the first thing I always ask people is what they were like as a child and where they grew up. So let's hear it.
So I grew up right outside of Philly, and I was a weird kid. I really just kind of marched to the beat of my own drum. My parents split when I was super, super young, and was an only child for a long time. And my parents, my mom got remarried, and I had my brother was born, and my brother was born with severe brain damage and cerebral palsy. So growing up, like navigating that, I feel like really shaped me into who I am today. But I mean, I was weird. I didn't really have a lot of friends. I kind of was friends with everyone, but it wasn't like a deep friendship.
Sure.
I came out on my 16th birthday, and I was the only openly gay kid in my high school. I don't know. I have a lot of compassion for young Allie looking back, and I struggled a lot. I had pretty bad depression at a young age.
I love it. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but I love what you said there that you looking back, sorry, that's my dog in the background, that you looking back have a lot of compassion for your younger self, because I think that that's such a beautiful place to like be able to get to. And I feel that too in some of my upbringing. And I had a pretty great upbringing, honestly, but there are parts of, things I remember feeling in high school and or things I was working through in my like not fully developed brain. None of us are at that age fully developed in our brains even. We're still learning, and I was felt so bad about myself that I couldn't understand or couldn't make sense of this or that relationship or this person. And I look back on it now and like I want to like go back and give myself a hug. Like little Carrie, I want to give her a hug.
I completely agree. And it's like I didn't have the vocabulary than to express or explain, what was happening or what was going on. And I was confused, and I'm just trying to navigate things. And yeah.
It's just it's one of those things that the best thing we can do, I think, is like look back on it now, as we're adults and just have that compassion for ourselves. But sometimes it's even hard to get to that point. But I mean, even that is a huge step, I feel like.
Yeah. I mean, it's taken a long time. I just turned 30 this past year in quarantine. And I mean, it's taken me, it took me 26 years to get to the point where, I'm in a healthy space, but it was a lot of work, and I'd be lying if I didn't, it was a
Yeah.
lot.
Can I ask you what your coming out experience was like? Because, I think different people come out at different points in their life, and sometimes they're ready at an earlier age and sometimes they're not. What was that like for you? You described yourself as weird, and that would maybe be another thing where like would make you more quasi weird or whatever it is. But you obviously had enough, understanding of yourself to know that that's who you truly were and that's who you wanted to be.
I credit a lot of it. It was already in my sphere. My aunt is gay, and really in my eyes was like a trailblazer for a lot of my family. My whole dad's side, you love her, I love her, like super embracive. My mom's side is super religious and Catholic. I grew up, went to Catholic school, so there's that, dealing with. And it was just It honestly just felt like I got to a point, little 16-year-old me, literally on my 16th birthday, we're cleaning up, from the party and stuff. And I just turned to my stepdad and I'm like, I have something to tell you. Like, I'm nervous to tell you. He's like, are you pregnant? And I'm like, well, probably quite the exact opposite. And, I told him, and he's like, well, you should probably go up and tell your mom. And it was just, I couldn't keep it in anymore. Like I felt like I was bursting at the seams, I figured it out and I was just like, I'll be damned, this is me. And my family has become, you know, they're super supportive and they've been really great. So it was definitely, I don't even know how to explain it. I was just bursting.
Yeah, no, that's the perfect way to explain it. That sounds so amazing. And, you know, I've always heard like that thing where it's like when you were in trouble, you're supposed to tell your parents something really, really bad and that, you know, to like get them prepped up and then just be like, no, I was just kidding. But like, I also got a speeding ticket. You could be like I crashed my car and it's broken and they're going to be like, what? And you can be like, no, just kidding. But I got a speeding ticket. So that's kind of like in reverse, like how that works.
Lessen the blow. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So how was, you know, on into high school and then what was your college experience like? Did you go to college and how did that shape you going forward?
I did. I was recruited for soccer to Ripon College in Wisconsin, little old Ripon. And I was actually 2.5 years pre-med. I was sitting with an advisor and she looked at my notes, my organic chemistry notes, and was like, have you ever looked into graphic design? And I was like, no. And so we went home, looked it up and fell in love. A month later, you know, applied and got into the Art Institute of California. Cause I mean, if you're just go big, I suppose in life changes. A month and a half later, moved out to California and, you know, eventually made my way back to Chicago where I finished at the Art Institute there. But never looked back. One of the best decisions I've ever made.
So where did pre-med come from? Was it one of those things where you grew up like always knowing that like lawyer, doctor, nurse, whatever, you know, or where did that come from?
Yeah, it was always, that was always like the vision, the dream, my passion. It was always pre-med. I wanted to be an ER doctor and I just... my passion smacked me in the face.
Yeah. So before she even said that to you, had you ever thought of graphic? Like, did that ever even register? You know, I think it's one of those things where sometimes the answer is right in front of you, but you're so close to it, you can't see it. And right. Then someone forces you to take a step back and you're like, well, fucking duh. Like, you know, I don't know.
Right. Yeah. No. And as soon as I saw it, it was just like, this is it, you know, it's perfect. And some of the most incredible experiences and opportunities have come from this. And it's pretty unfathomable looking back in just where it's led me.
What was the culture shock? You know, the East Coast, of course, is one beast. And then the Midwest, and you're slowly making your way out, you know, to California. Those are a lot of different culture shocks there. What was that like for you?
Yeah. So initially, you know, it was always in my mind, California was going to fix everything. You know, I wasn't in a great space. Like I was in a deep depression. Like it was the height of so many things. Like I was not equipped to be, you know, what on my own, like I needed a support structure around me. But I just put it all in California's the answer. And it wasn't, you know, I came out here and I was face down in my bed, you know, most of the time when I wasn't in school and, you know, really not thriving. And so I eventually transferred and wound up in Chicago where, you know, I met all of my people and, you know, Chicago forever has my heart. So it's really, you know, the things and people that you surround yourself with can really just, I was like, if I can only just pick them up and bring them into like a little more sunshine and beach, but,
yeah, I feel that. I'm very like pro Midwest. I love Wisconsin to my core, but we were talking before we started recording, this time of year is really like, you know, it tests me in, you know, my mental health and in a lot of other ways. I love nature and being outside, and this time of year, it's just not conducive to doing anything outside, and it can be really hard.
Yeah, it really can.
Yeah, some of the times I'm like, oh, California's looking pretty good.
Yep.
So yeah. I'm curious how like you crafted your community in Chicago, and is that where you started playing rugby?
Yeah. So I attribute most of it, if not all, to rugby. I grew up playing soccer, basketball, like a litany of sports. There is nothing like the rugby community. I was in a coffee shop in a Caribou Coffee in downtown Chicago. And it was, I was waiting for my therapist appointment, and girl walks in with a broken arm and a rugby shirt on. Naturally, we start talking, and she's like, "You look like you could, you know, kick some ass. Have you ever played rugby?" And I'm like, "No." And she's like, "Well, here's my number. Practices, you know, Thursday. Come on out." And so went home, Googled rugby. I was like, yes. Went to practice. They taught me everything. We went on that year. We won the national championship. I don't even know how to begin to describe rugby. There's a position for everybody. It's a community. It's the only sport where you can, you know, be super aggressive and, you know, fight each other the whole game. And then afterwards, it's culture that you go to the bar and you share a drink, you know, with your opposing teammate. And it's just, it's unlike any sport I've ever played. The camaraderie, just everything about it. It's led me to meet my best friends. It's taken me to, you know, countries and places I would have never imagined. I went on a, you know, all-star tour to Ireland, rugby, Ireland, London, and Wales. And it's just, it's cool. Lots of bruises. It's great.
Yeah, no, I'm only familiar with rugby through my brother, but, you know, we grew up in a small town in Wisconsin, a small rural town, and there's no such thing as rugby anywhere near here. But he went to college and went to, you know, college town, Eau Claire, which is still not a big city, definitely not by California standards. And they had a rugby team, and he literally, I mean, he was obsessed like from the get-go, and for the same reasons that you said. He just, you know, the athleticism part of it, you know, the aspects of it, the aspect of sport that it combines, you know, it is kind of like a hybrid of soccer and like, you know, American football and these other things. But then the community around it and like the camaraderie, I mean, he was hooked from the get-go, and he is now a college coach, and his whole life revolves around it. And I'm still like very, like there's still parts of it I don't understand because it's not as big, you know, you don't see it on TV as much, but I definitely have such a respect for the rugby community as a whole, because like you said, it's like, everyone's like one big family. And it was funny when you said you guys enjoy a drink afterwards, I was like, a drink. Yeah. I don't drink.
Yeah.
I don't like to drink. Yeah. And it's just part of the community and the culture, and it really brings people together. And I know he's met, you know, his soon to be wife through rugby, and it's incredible. And I feel like rugby people are very evangelical in that they want to make everyone else rugby people.
Yeah. I mean, I run a nonprofit, and in my intro emails, I mentioned that I play rugby, because the minute like people respond like, oh, I'm a rugger, and it's instant, oh, we're family. Like, yeah. I got you. I know kind of like your vibe, you know, you're good people. And yeah, it's just this instant. Yeah.
How do you think rugby and building that community like contributed to you, you know, having that core in Chicago, but then also you've mentioned a couple of times you're struggling with mental health. Has that helped in that sense? I mean, from my struggles with mental health, I know having a community around me is like one of the things that keeps me most grounded. So having that community around rugby and having these people who were just like your family, did that give you that sense of purpose and help you there when you were moving into Chicago?
It did. And it's, you know, it's twofold, because so the last time I was hospitalized was in 2016 after a suicide attempt. And I started playing rugby in 2011. So surely that was not, you know, the end all be all. Everything is perfect and wonderful. I struggled while I played rugby, during the season, during big games. I was hospitalized and I missed, you know, a few big games. And while I was in the hospital, my teammates would bring me like piles of letters and notes from my teammates of just love and encouragement. And I remember my first practice back, everyone just kind of individually coming up to me and just, you know, loving me up or giving me a hug and just like, we're glad you're back. It's huge. And I really can't emphasize enough how much those things, those actions, big or small, especially the small, how much and how far that goes, because it may not feel like much to you, but to the person struggling, like, you know, feeling seen, feeling heard, feeling valued, it's monumental. And I'm such a huge proponent of like, the little things. Love is in the little things.
Yeah. Wow. I couldn't agree with that more. It's so funny. I've kind of made it, and I'm not the best at this. Sometimes I forget, but I've kind of made it a point that like when I see, and you know, how we react to, or how we interact with strangers nowadays is so different because of COVID. But, you know, I was kind of thinking I need to make it a point that when I see someone and I'm taken by something, whether it's their shoes or I like their hairstyle or whatever it is, like to tell that person in that moment, because I've had people do that to me where I'm just walking down the street and someone will just be like, oh my God, I love your shoes. And it's like, they're not just being like, oh, I like your shoes. Like they're like genuinely giving me a compliment that they like my shoes or they like my hair or whatever it is. And those moments have really like, as little as they sounded, you know, they really made a difference to me. They made me smile. They made me feel seen in that moment. They made me just, I don't know, take a breath. And I'm trying to be better about that. Like I said, it's harder because of COVID. You don't want to get too close to strangers these days, but you know, those little things just, they matter so much. And even when it's to a random person, you don't know.
Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't agree more.
That's so awesome. And I love that you have that support. Now, how did you make your way out to California? How long were you in Chicago and when did you land in California?
I was in Chicago for about 8 years. Just recently moved to Chicago. It's been just 2 years now. We moved New Year's Day a few years ago, like literally fleeing the polar vortex of Chicago. So just trying to outrun it. We fled Chicago and wound up in California. I got a job at a surf branding agency and was super excited, like overlooked the ocean and just wanted a change. But then pretty serendipitously, like in a weird way, you know, COVID happened and I was starting to like navigate into more of a full-time role with my nonprofit and didn't have really the courage to just take that leap. And COVID kind of has thrust me into that leap. So I've really embraced the nonprofit. We got an office space, which I'm sitting in, and it's grown in ways that I really can't even begin to describe.
So you were doing graphic design when you first got your way out there, when you got the job at the surf shop, correct?
Yes, correct.
Okay. And tell us about, you've hinted about it a little bit, but your nonprofit, tell us when you started it, tell us what it's called, just kind of give us the specs. And then I want to dive in deeper there.
Yeah. So right before we moved out here, I was the design lead for the NHL Winter Classic and Stadium Series. So I did that for a few years and designed like everything printed in the stadium and everything like that. So then transitioned, like graphic design has been my world. And I created Find Your Anchor in 2012, and it was actually like a senior kind of design project idea. And the requirements were like two collateral pieces. And I came up with this whole thing. It was like, I mean, if you were to put all the, it was like 10 different collateral pieces. And I was telling my professor about it and he was like, okay, great, do it. And I'm like, in like the same amount of time. And he's like, yeah. So just like threw myself into this and created Find Your Anchor. When I talk about it too, it's always like at times I feel like a hypocrite because I created in 2012. The last time I was hospitalized was in 2016. So Find Your Anchor is a grassroots movement aimed at suicide awareness and prevention. It's a little blue box that we launch and send into the world. And I thought, you know, how can I tell people it's okay? You know, like you keep fighting and I can't take my own advice at times. And that was like a real struggle for me until I kind of reached this point where it was like, having struggled gives gives weight to my experience. And I think of like the Rogaine man and, you know, him having struggled, and it gave him, you know, wherewithal to be able to speak on the issue or know what helps or what hurts or what, you know, what falls flat. Really kind of reframing it, because that was like a roadblock in my life. So it's little blue box. You open the lid. It says, if you're feeling lost, hopeless, suicidal, this is for you. If not, leave it for someone else in need. Inside there's a deck of cards, 52 plus reasons to live, an infographic on depression, a letter, posters, list of resources, bracelet, pins, whole bunch of other good vibes. And the ideas that people can add to it, things that helped them or things that were anchors for them. And an anchor just being anything that someone can hold on to for another day or another minute. It really doesn't have to be profound or groundbreaking. It can be steak tacos. It can be a smile from a stranger. It can be, you know, Home Alone 2, Lost in New York. Oh, like literally
Home Alone 2.
Best. If I'm having a bad day, I'm putting it on and yeah. It's just instantly the best. And so it's just in those moments of darkness or just struggling, finding little joys to surround yourself, knowing what makes you smile, what makes you feel good, and grabbing onto them. So we encourage people when they're in a better space to add things that help them and then launch it for someone else in need. So we send them to people who are struggling. We partner with schools, organizations, communities. It's
so
more love,
amazing.
Just more love. I feel like just creativity and a personal touch is more in line, because everything that I encountered was just so corporate and sterile and cold. And I just felt like another statistic, and figured I wasn't alone. And really it just started as like my own kind of journey of healing has evolved into something much larger than myself. I mean, this time last year, we had about like 4,500 boxes in the world. And as of today, we're now at like 14,500 boxes.
That's so good. Wow.
Yeah. We always say it's, you know, simultaneously exciting and heartbreaking that, you know, the need is there, but, you know, glad people are reaching out and, you know, seeing this as a resource.
Yeah. You know, I'm an animal welfare advocate, and I work in shelters, and I volunteer, and I use like my talents on air to make videos and help get homeless abused pets adopted. And I feel the same way, that it's like, in a perfect world, there would be no shelters. In a perfect world, I would not have to make a video about, you know, a pit bull who was abused his entire life and is now the sweetest thing and just wants to be loved. You know, I wouldn't have to do that, but I will keep doing it. And it's just like you will keep doing it. And, you know, that's kind of the vibe I get. You, in a perfect world, it wouldn't exist, but also it needs to be a place where people who are struggling can have those resources. And you talk about the small anchors, which I think, I love that name, Find Your Anchor, because sometimes you're right. It's like, my anchor today is one thing, and then maybe tomorrow it's another thing. And I actually read a story, I forgot where I saw this, but there was a man who, was contemplating suicide. He had it like all lined up. He was going to do it, blah, blah, blah. He had everything like literally in place. And when the day came that to do it, he got to the point where he was like, I don't have anyone, I don't know who's going to take care of my cat, you know? And he ended up not committing suicide because that was the reason why. That was his anchor, was because he did not have anyone in line to take care of his cat. And it, like, even just saying that story, it gives me chills, because you just don't know what has to be that person's anchor to turn them off that ledge.
Yeah. It's you're spot on. And it's also like, accessibility to resources is such a huge issue. You know, when I got out of the hospital in 2016, they handed me a bill for $14,000.
Oh God.
Which I've like called my life tax, because that's the price you're putting on this. And as if I didn't have enough to be worrying about, now I've got, you know, pile on to financial issues. So with Find Your Anchor, we vow to keep the boxes free for those who are struggling. Clearly, there are enough barriers to resources, and it's just So the way we make that happen is our partnerships with schools and organizations. We partner with a lot of like universities, like health departments, state health departments have been have started to order things. We do workshops and like recurring box subscriptions, and we apply for a lot of grants given our model. And they always want to know, well, what's your data? Like, give us data, give us your numbers. And we've got data. Like on the inside flap of every box is a tracking number, a built-in tracking number, if you want to use it. So we know where every box is initially sent to. And we've got data. But I always say to them, I have pages and pages of emails and messages from people that say, I just wanted to let you know that you saved a life today.
Oh, God.
When I opened the box, I just started crying. You must have saved hundreds of lives by now. And it's like, how do you quantify that?
Yeah.
Because one life saved equals everything
exactly
I've put into this. And in a way, like, data takes away the story. And the story is everything, like everything. So it's this, you know, catch 22, because we need help with funding, mm-hmm. but it's so, yeah.
Wow. That's amazing. You talk about, you know, resources and, you know, the fact that a lot of people who are struggling, you know, maybe with their mental health, resources are a thing that keeps them, you know, a barrier to getting help. You know, I think when I was growing up, and I'm similar to you, I'm about to turn 30, so we're similar ages. But when I was growing up, I think therapy was really stigmatized. And I think we're getting to this place where it's not as stigmatized to say that, you know, you've gone to therapy or are in therapy. I fucking love therapy. It's the best thing ever. And I think everyone should go to therapy. I don't know how we do that, but do we subsidize therapy? I mean, I don't know, but the fact of the matter is it's very expensive to have therapy, and the people who a lot of times need it most can't get to it and find it. So I would just love to know your, you know, as someone who's just so entrenched in this space and has, you know, works with it directly, how do we even start to address that?
Yeah, we normalize it, you know, and it's, yeah. And, you know, a friend of mine has this whole campaign of like, therapy is cool.
So
and
cool.
I think of it as like, as maintenance, mm-hmm. You know,
yeah.
You take your car in for an oil change. Like, it's just, and my big hang up sometimes would be like, well, what if I don't have anything to talk about today? And it's like, talk about your pets. Mm-hmm. Like it's this space for you to just get it off your chest. And I mean, the accessibility is also because therapy is expensive.
Yes.
And I don't know, like out in California, a lot of therapists don't even go through insurance and they're like cash only. Mm-hmm. And it's like $150, $200 a session. And it's like, that's not, how do we ever breach this?
Yeah.
You know? Like but there's actually a lot of really great clinics, and there's a lot of, you know, if you search for like sliding scale stuff, there's a lot of clinics that do that.
That's amazing. Yeah. It's one of those things where the people who need it most. And, you know, I think about this too, you know, now that I'm in a bigger city here in Kansas City, you know, the homeless population here, and, you know, some of the people are homeless by choice. They choose to be, and they choose to live a lifestyle, but there are a lot of situations where I know these people, like this particular group of homeless people, or this person is struggling with mental health issues, and that perpetuates the homelessness cycle, and they can't get a job because they can't get a handle on it or even get prescribed medication that might help them. And it's such a cycle that as you said, accessibility, the first step is like being able to get them to seeing someone, but they can't afford it, and they don't know where to find it, and they don't even know who to go to point them in the direction. And the fact of the matter is, a lot of people look at homeless people like, or try not to look at them, you know, for lack of a better, you know, and so it's just this cycle where I don't even know how we address it and make it accessible for people. But I think what you're doing with these boxes, it's like almost, it can be therapy in a box. And I think that's maybe what you're trying to do, is like, it's not going to replace having a therapy session, but it might just give you that thing that's going to say it's okay.
Yeah. Well, and you know, it's something physical, something tangible. So I think of like object permanence and knowing that it's sitting on my shelf. If I need to grab it, I know that it's there.
Yeah.
And even with like our workshops, and we do like employee wellness and box building events, it's therapeutic for the box builder. And even, you know, sometimes it's under the guise of like sneaky mental health. Like a lot of times we work with teens or with vets. We have vet specific boxes. And a lot of times they may not want to admit that they're struggling or, you know, super defensive about it. And it's like, you know, we know it's not free. It doesn't have to be for you. You're helping, you know, we're all about strangers who care. My fundamental core belief in like the height of my darkness was that nobody would care. I couldn't feel the love and support that I was surrounded by. So I thought if I could create something that showed you that a stranger cares about you, then maybe it won't be so hard to believe that your friends and family do as well. So all about strangers who care. And so it's like to be able to recreate or like simulate that feeling of gifting that. Like one of the most, every time I launch a box just organically into the world, we'll launch them just like in the self-help section of the library, on the 14th floor of Caesars in Vegas, like in a Starbucks, like on the beach trail, like literally anywhere and everywhere, and just trusting in the universe that the right person, you know, stumbles on it. We've heard from people that have found boxes organically that it's felt like divine intervention. And just there's really something powerful in putting a box someplace meaningful to you, trusting, and just walking away. Like the first box that I launched was in the self-help section of the Gail Borden Library in Elgin, Illinois. And I put it on the shelf and I'm standing there and I'm like, should I put it up a shelf higher? Is this eye level?
You're like thinking it over so intensely.
Overthinking everything. And I'm just like, trust. Like there was just this overwhelming sense of just trust. And I walk away, I turn, I'm like, should I look? Like, should I watch? And it was just trust. It's just this flooding sense of trust. And just, I walked out and never knowing, but just
trusting.
And then I got an email a week later from a girl that said, I, you know, when I opened the box, I just started crying. This is the what, like, you must have saved hundreds of lives. This is my first box.
Oh my gosh. Wow. That's so powerful, Allie. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Can I ask you what some of your techniques for caring for yourself during all of this? And I know if from my experience, you know, caring for others and, you know, the way I, you know, care for animals, that fills me up and make, you know, that's the way I care for myself, is to care for others and care for animals. Is that something that you find your anchor? And do you have any other ways that you care for yourself?
Yeah. So, I mean, that definitely fuels me and keeps me going. And, you know, I have a running doc of ongoing like testimonials and messages from people. So if I'm, you know, stressed out or something, you know, I read through them and it reinforces, you know, why I'm, you know, putting so much into this. Physical self-care and just like unplugging and going outside and really just creating that space. I found Headspace has been like doing wonders for me. I've never really been into meditation, and like even with like CBT, I always struggled with the mindfulness piece. But Headspace really just, it gives it to me in like digestible pieces, and it's really tailored to specific things.
Yes.
I promise I'm not getting paid by Headspace, but it's phenomenal. And then also just doing a lot of like self-work of recognizing cognitive distortions was a game changer for me, to be able to verbalize like a distortion, or to be able to sit there and reframe something like, you know, I'm mind reading right now. I have no possible idea what she's really thinking. Like, that's not fair to, you know, or I'm catastrophizing. That did not lead to that. That is not what they said. And to be able to recognize what it is was so powerful. And just to be able to have the vocabulary.
Yeah. You know, that's a version. You said the mindfulness stuff was hard for you, but that's a version of like mindfulness, is just being able to like pick out the parts where the story you're telling, like the story that's playing in your head, is not reality. And like, and being able to recognize that the story, that it truly is all just a story. And I want to, I'm also not being paid by Headspace, but they do a really great job. I know on the app, and I do some, now that I've been meditating for a while, I do some deeper stuff. But when I was first starting, it was so good. And they have these little videos and they like explain it so well. And it, and the guy, I don't know if it's the same guy, but he has this great accent that just really, yes, you know, stimulates me in some way.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so calming. Yep. Yep. I have the one, I especially like, if I'll wake up in the middle of the night and have a trouble falling asleep, I've got that one on like repeat.
Yes.
It's like count backwards from, what is it? Like 100,000.
Yeah. And in some of the ways, like they'll have those exercises and in my head, I'm like, there's no fucking way this works. And then, you know, 30 seconds later, I'm fine. Like it's worked.
Yeah. It's revolutionary.
Yeah.
It's cool. It's mind blowing every time, really, just to be reinforced of how much like our mind and body are connected.
Yeah. No, it's so true. I'm wondering, is there any connection or how do you see the box evolving and the nonprofit evolving into a place where, you know, not only do you have your anchor, you know, find your anchor, you have this box and it's given you that thing to hold on to, or given you that understanding for that little bit. How do you like move into the next piece where you actually, you know, work towards, whether it's medication or therapy? Do you guys have something in place where you want to be able to set up, whether it's, I don't know, retreats or I don't know, I'm kind of just throwing stuff out there now, but like, what's the next step for how you guys see it evolving?
I would love to see us doing more workshops and, yeah, and even just, I'd love to work more with like the prison system.
Yes.
And getting this in there, even like to help build boxes and just like meaningful work. And working more in the veteran space. Getting more of our vet boxes. We worked a little bit with Wounded Warrior Project in creating the vet box. We also recently partnered with our dear friends at Born This Way Foundation, which is Lady Gaga's, yeah, foundation. And we created the Please Stay Pledge. And so it's a printed pledge. They're in all of our boxes now. And it's, you know, literally a pledge to stay. It has some resources in there, some self-care ideas, you know, soul-filling acts, helping others helps yourself, helps, you know, feel good, make sure you're taking care of yourself. So we've got these, and then a website, pleasestay.us. And so really just trying to get more partnerships, more of our boxes. We recently partnered with the Teen Mental Health First Aid, and they just got 10,000 boxes that we're sending to schools all throughout the country. So yeah, there's lots in the works, but yeah, just
what is an area that you know, think that maybe it's like unbeknownst to the public really kind of struggles with some of this stuff? I was really surprised to hear that you mentioned, but veterinarians actually have a pretty high rate of suicide or trying to commit suicide. That was one group where I was just like, that blew my mind.
It's the highest.
That's insane.
Yeah. Yep. We've actually talked about with Banfield about getting some boxes,
yes,
into vet offices. But yeah, that was really surprising to me. And I feel like also we're seeing more and more of athletes and like professional athletes.
Wow. It's another one too. You wouldn't think. And I think it's, and I'm not sure, but it's one of those things where there's no bounds to who's affected by this. And I've heard it the same time and time again, you know, it's the misunderstood teenager. It's the guy on Wall Street who, you know, is about to lose it. And, you know, if he loses all his money, in his mind, he's a failure and he's not worth it anymore. Or it's the mom who is so just, I don't know, misunderstood or just can't find herself anymore. It's like, there's no like religion or gender or anything that it discriminates against. No social class. Exactly. It truly is something that I think it has no bounds of who it affects.
Yeah.
it's just one of those things where it's like, so you have all these people to serve, and it's kind of like, you know, I'm in marketing. You always think of like your target market, like, and you literally like your target market is so many people. Yeah, it's everyone. And I'm sure it's a little overwhelming at times, but it's also a humanizing aspect too, that it has no bounds.
Yeah. And you know, if there's so many awful, terrible things out of COVID, but in like a weird, twisted way, it's given people, I feel like, a taste of mental health. I feel like before COVID, mental health, you know, it's either people knew it and like could talk about it, or they're like, I don't know anyone, I can't relate. I have no idea. COVID's given everyone a taste of mental health in some way, you know, whether it's some fleeting anxiety of, am I going to get enough toilet paper to stock up? Like, am I, you know, what does this mean? What's happening? Like an impending doom? Like, now everyone's got a little taste of that. And so in a weird, twisted way, because of course you don't want anyone to ever struggle, but it's now maybe we have a baseline and a foundation to work from, you know, whereas before we weren't on the same level, or we weren't on the same field. And certainly, you know, people are struggling way more than others, but now maybe it's just a piece to kind of work from.
That's such a good way to put it. And there's so many, I mean, every day I turn on my computer and I have articles come up like how to stay sane during COVID, how to do that. And, you know, before that, before all this, we weren't really talking about that. And it's kind of a message of how do we stay connected with while we're not connected. And it's kind of this dichotomy of doing that. Is there some kind of, I mean, I know you guys have a Instagram page and whatnot, but is there a community that you guys, you know, do you have a Facebook group or something where people can go talk to other people? Cause I know for me, when I'm struggling the most, a lot of times it's like, I need time to myself, but then like, I need to be connected to other people and know that I'm not alone. And so I think of like a community. Do you have anything like that for people?
We don't have an official thing. We found people go to our social medias and like, especially Facebook, and we'll kind of message of or comment, you know, just found this box or just mm-hmm. launched box, you know, number 2367, you know, by the bridge in San Diego. And we'll have people that'll actually respond like this father and son went on a scavenger hunt to go find it. So little things like that, not as much, like support groups or chat groups, but, little things like that in the box launching.
I love that.
I like that though.
Yeah. What do you see as being like the ultimate goal for Find Your Anchor? What's your big vision and your big dream for it? And for you too, you know, I think of, you know, sometimes your vision for yourself is separate from your business. Those don't have to be, you know, the same thing. What's your vision for the business and for yourself?
With the business, I really more boxes. I mean, let's dream real big, you know, a box in every school, in every public library, and on every college campus. There's no shortage of need for it. And I think just the more organic kind of personal touch resources, the better. On a personal, I wrote a book. So it would be incredible for that to take flight. It's in the works of pitch. Like I have I'm represented and everything like that. So it's cool. It's called Find Your Anchor. And it's a typographic memoir. So when I was last hospitalized, I was inpatient for 13 days and I kept track of everything. I wrote everything. So it's kind of a culmination of that. And then like leading into the story of creating Find Your Anchor, the movement. So fingers crossed, you know, something with that. And I really just think sharing more of my story, I would love to do more of like the speaking kind of route. And
yes,
that's how we normalize these conversations. You know, someone asked me, you know, why did you, what led you to start speaking about this? And like, what led you to write the book? And, you know, I wrote a slam poem and performing that. And you know, what led you, what was that spark? And I say that I was told not to. My girlfriend at the time told me, why are you telling people this? People don't need to know about that. And that is what I, you know, I said, this is the problem, and got rid of her and, you know, shared. I just think back to that moment. And it's just like, that is what's so wrong, you know?
She could not be more wrong. Like, I don't know any other way to say it other than, and I'm glad that you arrived at that on your own, because she could not be more wrong. I'm telling you right now.
Yeah. And it really, that was like the catalyst, like, well, now I'm telling it, you know? So somewhat, can I borrow someone's megaphone, please?
Hey, you can use my megaphone any day.
Thank you.
That's incredible. Writing a book, I know, is one of those things. It's like, I've never had a child, but it's like birthing a child into the world is from what I hear. So that is impressive in and of itself. If people want to support Find Your Anchor in, you know, in a variety of different ways, what different ways can they support Find Your Anchor?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, I mean, we're always open and, you know, encouraging more partnerships. So if you're a school, if you're at, you know, a doctor's office, like any sort of office, community, like I would love to chat and just get, you know, we have bulk order of boxes, recurring box subscriptions, and you can donate right on our website. A $25 donation covers the assembly and shipping of a box to someone struggling. And yeah, I mean, and if you know someone struggling, really, I just can't echo enough, like, how you can help is just having that conversation. At the end of the day, that is our goal, is for people to feel loved, supported, and heard. And, you know, I believe it's Jed Foundation says it best, like, seize the awkward. You know, the conversation is going to feel uncomfortable. It's not an easy conversation to have. But what's the alternative? You know, knowing that your person is struggling in silence, you know, seize the awkward and be there for them, because it's invaluable. And I promise you, it is worth it.
That's so amazing. Where can you tell us, like, the Instagram handles, your handles, the company's handles, yeah, Facebook, all that other stuff? Share that all with us.
Yep. So findyouranchor.us is our website. Facebook is just Find Your Anchor. Instagram is at Find Your Anchor Box. Twitter is at FYA Box. And our new initiative, Sign the Please Stay Pledge, at pleasestay.us.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Allie. I really appreciate it. And what you're doing is so incredible.
Thank you so much, Carrie. I'm so grateful for the opportunity to chat and for this space.
That was founder and CEO of Find Your Anchor, Allie Borowski. If you or someone you know is struggling with thoughts of suicide, please call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 800-273-8255. It's open and available 24 hours a day. For more inspiring interviews with people like Allie, head on over to carriegillespie.com/podcast. You can keep up with the show on Instagram and follow us there. We are at Candidly Speaking Podcast, and I am at carrie.gillespie. In the meantime, for more information, you can go to carriegillespie.com/podcast. If you guys are enjoying the show today and enjoying the show in general, it would mean the world to me if you went to Apple Podcasts and left us a rating and wrote a short review about why you love the show. It really helps us grow, helps us, you know, just get more people on the show, helps us find out what we're doing right. And it just really helps propel us forward. So I appreciate any feedback you guys are willing to give. Thanks so much, y'all, for being here. I appreciate it so much. We will see you next time.